I'm a big believer that the true values of an organization are not the virtues that they put on their website. The values of the organization is where they spend their time, their mind share, and their resources. As you define that, as you lay out the strategy, as you build the processes to kind of keep yourself accountable through the journey, that builds the culture that you really want in the organization.
Welcome to The Business of Doing Business. I'm your host, Dwayne Kerrigan. With 35 years in business and close to 30 ventures across 12 industries, I've seen a lot. Amid the celebrity allure of entrepreneurship, many exceptional entrepreneurs remain shadowed. Here, I team up with these hidden talents to unveil their challenges and successes. Dive in with me to unearth entrepreneurial gems, learn from our experiences, and get educated. General Craig Nixon, I am so grateful and honored to have you on the show today. I can't even express my gratitude for you to be here. Friends of friends connected back in, I think, 2011, 2012, when you were retiring through Kirk Cronin. If you don't mind, I'm just going to kind of give a little bit of background for the listeners, and you can maybe fill in if I've made some errors. I've tried to keep this as tight as possible, because if I did the whole thing, I think the podcast, like after the introduction, I'd be just saying, okay, thanks very much, folks, and that'd be the end of the podcast. But 30-year career in the Army, Brigadier General, Director of Operations for JSOC in Afghanistan and Iraq, and Commander of the 75th Ranger Regiment, Director of Ops for the U.S. Special Ops Council, Deputy Commanding General Officer of the 25th Infantry, which I think, and maybe you could just kind of fill me in, but I mean, we're talking thousands and thousands of troops here that you were in charge of at the time. And then you served in conflicts, I mean, obviously all over the world, and have been awarded the Distinguished Service Medal, the Silver Star, 3 Bronze Stars, the Purple Heart. And then once that career is all over, you retire in 2011, join General McChrystal in as a partner in McChrystal Group, consulting firm, and then left there after, I think, a couple of years and became the CEO of Academy, which then turned into the Constellis Group. And I believe they're, you know, somewhere in the 15 to 20,000 employee range and upwards of over $1 billion in revenue. Have I kind of gleaned the very surface of what you've done over an impressive career?
Could I never feel old till somebody reads my bio or I see my picture? But that's a good synopsis of my career.
I knew the background, but I was really kind of diving into it yesterday. And at 1:43 this morning, I woke up and went, holy shit, I'm going to be interviewing General Craig Nixon. So how would you prefer me to address you? Craig?
Craig, please.
Again, I can't reiterate my gratitude for you being here. My first question actually came about when I was doing the research on your podcast. And as I was going through the career, the daunting question that kept on kind of pounding into my head at the time was, with a career like yours in the Army, you go from military into business, conquer both areas. I'm curious, what was the driving force and how did that evolve? And I'm really kind of asking to go back to almost the beginning. What was that driving force and what pulled the compassion or the passion and the drive to kind of just keep going through all this time and all this change and all the different environments you've been in the world? It's almost unfathomable.
Yeah, that's a pretty deep question. I think it'll be helpful because a lot of it's kind of, it does kind of go all the way back. I was raised in the military, so my father was in the military, so we traveled all over the world. About every 2 or 3 years, we were moving to another location. We lived in Japan, we lived in Europe, and then obviously after college, I joined the military and did the same thing. So my whole life has been about new experiences, doing new things, finding stuff that's intellectually challenging, but a lot of it was kind of serendipity. I mean, I graduated from college. I actually entered the military on a military leave of absence. I was working at UPS at the time, which was a great company. At that time, you could join the military, spend 4 years, and then come back to UPS. So I took a pay cut to join the Army. And then once I got into it, I like self-actualized in the Army. I just loved what we were doing. And then I was fortunate enough to get into the Rangers fairly early. And that kind of became my career. Post-military was more about, one, I was working with a really good friend. Stan McChrystal was one of my mentors. I had followed him in six jobs over the decades we had been in. And we built McChrystal Group specifically to take the lessons we had learned from transforming special operations and applying those to business. It was, in one way, reflected on what we had done. On another, it was what transfers to business, what actually will work in that environment, which was really interesting on a number of levels. And I can go into more detail, but then I got the opportunity to run Academy, which was formerly named Blackwater. So it was kind of put up or shut up. You know, I had gotten out, I had started an executive leadership course at McChrystal Group, ran hundreds of people, C-suite people through that, advised a number of companies in Silicon Valley as a partner there. I had taught it, consulted on it, had the opportunity to do it, and then had a pretty good run as the CEO there building Costellas Group. So that was the path. I'm still searching for, you know, what I want to do when I grow up.
That's funny that you say that, because that's one of my favorite sayings. It's probably why I've owned so many businesses and I never feel like I'm going to retire. A little bit back there, when you were talking about getting into the Army and you used the words, I loved what we were doing. Do you mind if we just go back and start a little bit on that?
Sure.
I mean, I think it lends to some buzzwords nowadays, passion, purpose. I guess just for context purposes, how old were you when you kind of went into the Army?
22.
So young. Was it the Ranger action stuff that you loved at the time, or was it purpose-driven, or was it the camaraderie? Like, what would that be if you could kind of frame it up?
Well, first off, I didn't start. I mean, I went to Ranger school, but I wasn't in the Ranger regiment until probably 6 years later. But I think what attracted me to the Army was and it's overused, but it was being part of something that was bigger than yourself. I think that was one of the things. So that is, you know, a sense of purpose around that. But more than that, it was around working with people. And the Army does an incredible job of teaching leadership at echelon. So the kind of foundation of the Army is that you're proficient two levels down and one level up, so that you're capable in any organization of doing the job two levels below you, and you're capable of replacing the guy above you. And they do a very good job of having institutional training, giving you the resources to do self-training, and then giving you experiences to kind of work through that system. So the first organization that I led was about 40 people, a platoon. And I had the opportunity to lead a couple of different platoons. So I think that's what attracted me to it. I was good at it. I enjoyed working with the people to do it. I had some incredible bosses early on that took an interest in mentoring me. And I think that's what attracted me to it. The next level of that was when I got into the Rangers, because that was kind of, the Rangers at that time were built to show if you brought the right people and gave them the right resources, what the true capabilities of the Army could be. And then once you've done that, to go back out to the big Army, transfer those lessons learned to the big Army. And then some would actually get the chance to go back into the Rangers. So that's what I did for the rest of my career.
You kind of mentioned three different kind of pieces that I kind of grabbed a hold of. One was the statement of the Army was bigger than yourself. And then the one level up, two levels down, and then you tweaked on mentoring. I'm curious, if you don't mind, if I could dig in a little bit into a couple of those sections, how it applied maybe for you, but also how maybe you see how it applies today in the world that is moving forward. I'm always of the mind that, you know, it's a beautiful life. We're better off today than we were, you know, yesterday. But there are some interesting things at play, technology and coming out of the pandemic and all that kind of stuff. And there's, you know, so there's a social, I don't want to call it struggle, but there's just definitely is some push-pull in terms of at a social level. At the bigger than yourself piece, what did that mean to you in the beginning? And then how would you look at that and provide guidance, mentorship, something to think about for people who own businesses or are moving into politics or moving into the military or moving into any realm of life, kids, families, the family unit? How would you contextualize that today and utilize that whole concept of bigger than yourself?
I mean, there's a couple of different aspects to that, but I would start with, I was, again, raised in a military family that believed in hard work and community. Both of my parents believed in giving back to the community. I have four kids and one grandchild now, which is life-changing for everybody that hasn't had their first grandchild yet. But what I've told all my kids and what I talked to people about early on is, you know, we are incredibly fortunate to be in the country that we're at in the time that we're at. It is a glass full. There's lots of challenges, as you talked about, and we can drill down on those. But I think it's incumbent on all of us to give back at some level. And it doesn't have to be service in the military, but we owe back to this community that has given us so much within your subset of skills, whether that's a mentoring program or church or community. And oh, by the way, you get much more out of it than you actually give. So that's kind of always been foundational for me. As a business leader, I think you have a couple of different responsibilities. First responsibility is, it was easy in the Army. You had a sense of purpose. It was kind of given to you. As a business leader, I think for your company, you've got to create that sense of purpose. And that manifests itself partly in vision. But I believe CEOs, first and foremost, their primary job is to create an environment for other people to excel. And to do that, that ties, you have to have a vision of where you want to go. But as importantly, you've got to have the framework and the structure and the processes to involve people in that journey. And they have to feel like they're involved in that journey. Both of those things kind of play out as you move forward.
If you had to give some advice, because I know you do a lot. Your resume is just speaks for itself. But for the CEOs out there that are struggling or don't have a vision, or they think they might have a vision, would you kind of frame out some pieces inside of vision that they may want to consider or reconsider based on their current vision? Some people don't have a vision, or they think they have a vision, and then they're not getting the results from that vision. And when they're not getting the results, it's like, well, they look at everybody else sometimes, well, not all the time, but they will look at other people and go, well, it's their fault, versus, really it rests on the leader. So I'm just curious, from your experience, what components of vision might you consider?
At its simplest level is to be able to project your organization forward in time. And what do you want it to look like 5, 10, 15 years down the road? How do you want it to be in the space that you're in? I want to be the market leader in X, Y, and G. I want to be part of the community. I want employees that want to come to work and interact well with each other. I want to give back to my employees and communities. But clearly define that, not in detail, but in broad terms. Next step is, and what's the strategy to get there? And I think a strategy is ends, ways, and means. So if you can define the end, then there's multiple ways to get to that. And you're going to continue to iterate and adjust that along the journey. And then you've got a resource. I'm a big believer that the true values of an organization are not the virtues that they put on their website. The values of the organization is where they spend their time, their mind share, and their resources. So as you define that, as you lay out the strategy, as you build the processes to kind of keep yourself accountable through the journey, that builds the culture that you really want in the organization.
Wow. Okay. You said time, mind share, and resources. And then, but before that, you said at the ends, the ways, and the means. Is that correct? So the ends, I get, Can you maybe describe the ways and means for listeners just so that they can understand your context to it?
Let me use an example. When I took over Academy, it was a pretty significant turnaround. And so I did an assessment early on. The first board meeting was kind of a, you know, your baby's ugly board meeting. And I had an incredible board, and the board said, okay, great. Now what are we going to do about it? So we put together a team, cross-functional team, internal, and I brought some external resources, and we built the strategy. And the strategy was a path to $1 billion. At the time, we were probably, I don't know, $350 million in revenue. So the strategy was to $1 billion. There's many different ways to get from where we were at to where we were going. But broadly, it was a combination of organic growth, and obviously we had objectives inside the organic growth combined with acquisitions was the path that we were going to get to. And I think just laying out the broad lines of effort with objectives to get to that end state that you're talking about is the way I approach it. I use an alignment triangle generally that starts with your values up top and your objectives over the next 2 to 5 years. And then the tactics for each one of those objectives that are 6 months. So you're thinking about it in time and space as you move forward against lines of effort.
And correct me if I'm wrong, you know, based on that triangle, then do you apply the time, mind share, and resources into those sections in the triangle? Is that how it works? Or
yes, I mean, it's at the top of the triangle. It's what, you know, when you define, here's the ends that we're going at, here's the main objectives that we're doing, then you're using that to cross-check yourself. You know, are you being true to your objective? If your objective is, you know, to grow in one line of business, okay, have you put the resource against it? Do you have the right people at the right frequency talking about the right things to get there? Or are you going down multiple rat holes or waiting for the next unicorn to hit? So are you frittering away your time on other things?
Right. So ultimate focus. I'm curious, where do you land on accountability for, you know, the things that you are, you know, you apply your resources, you know, you're putting all your efforts towards this, you're building, in your example, building a stream of business, one line stream of business. Where and how do you measure and, you know, a value accountability and execute on that?
To me, the art is balancing autonomy and accountability. So on one level, you want people to have the freedom to operate and make decisions at their level, but they have to be held accountable for those decisions and the performance of their area. So I think first and foremost, it is, does the organization clearly understand the objectives that you're trying to accomplish? And what I find in a lot of organizations is they're being held accountable, but they have no idea where they're actually trying to drive the organization because there's a disconnect between the vision, the objectives, and what's actually going on day to day on the ground. So there has to be a clear understanding of what we used to call a shared sense of purpose, shared sense of consciousness and purpose. And that's driven through a very disciplined virtual battle rhythm or cadence. So are you bringing the right people together at the right time to make the right decisions? And then I think particularly as an organization gets larger, there's a shift in the focus of those forums. So in the early days of a startup, and McChrystal Group was a bootstrap startup. So we lived the, and I've been involved in a couple other startups. That requires one level of focus and one kind of leadership style. But as you transition to larger and more dispersed organizations, I believe that the focus, instead of the old, where it goes from analysis to synthesis to, you know, the great man or woman making a decision, it largely becomes about the leadership providing context down so the right level in the organization can make the right decisions. And there's a lot of products that you can use to help with that. I mean, we had what we called CCIR, CEO's critical information requirements. This is what I need to know when. You need to wake me up for this. this can wait till this, you know, whatever meeting, this, give me a summary. So and really think through what information you want and how you're going to act on it. And that's tied to a you know, decision authorities matrix. And that clearly articulates to people who owns it and then have the KPIs to actually monitor.
Do you use a software for that? As you're speaking about that, Craig, it reminds me, and I might be misinterpreting this, so please tell me if I am. But I remember in 2011, 2012, where I first met you, actually the only time we met, by proximity, I was invited to an initial analysis of what you guys were doing with CrossLead at the McChrystal Group. And I remember seeing a spreadsheet of kind of how you guys used to manage, you know, cadence and battle rhythm. And so is that the kind of thing that you're talking about? And I don't know if you know the spreadsheet that I'm thinking about, but it was very much like, okay, here's what has to happen. Here's how we communicate it. Here's how often we communicate it. Is this 3 times a day? Is this once a day? Is this every 2 weeks? Like, it was a pretty all-encompassing spreadsheet. And this is back in 2011. So now I'm sure it's replaced with a software.
Yeah, I think they have. I mean, to be honest, in the organizations, we were still just using the spreadsheet. Like when I was at Academy in Constellus, it was largely a spreadsheet driven. I think software clearly in today's world will help enable that. And AI, which is one of my particular interests, is going to enable that as it goes forward. I'm a big believer that time's the one constant in life. So, you know, if you can manage time against your objectives, that's a huge event.
Can you just expand on that a little bit for the listeners? I think that's a really powerful statement.
I think when you look at activities, and it really struck me back when I was in a planner in special operations, there was some activities, because you know, Kurt, I'll use the seal over the water type thing. It took a period of time. If everything went right, it took a period of time. And if you didn't account for that period of time and give yourself a buffer, it just wasn't going to happen. So synchronizing battlefield activities over time would increase significantly your chances of success. The same occurs in business. I mean, at the strategic level, it's activities, large activities over time synchronized. But to me, it's all about activities over time linked by decision points. So, and it gets back to your earlier question. You have KPIs that are leading indicators that allow you to make timely decisions at the right level? Or are you making decisions after the fact? It doesn't matter because it's a great decision, but you needed to make it 2 weeks ago because you can't run that product line or whatever type of business you're in. And what I've found largely is people don't really account for time as they're going through it, or they know it's there and just ignore it. I read a book a long time ago that had a pretty significant impact on me called The Logic of Failure. And it basically took disparate groups together, gave them problems, and then, you know, this early days, ran it through a computer simulation to see how they came out, and then it brought stuff out of it. And largely, people spend way too much time planning and not enough time adjusting after they start doing it. And largely, organizations, the more complex the problem is, the simpler the solution they look for. And that's the double whammy. You take too long, you look for a simple solution, and you don't adjust after it, as opposed to get the boat off the dock, adjust it, you know, make the thousands of adjustments, but you know which island you're headed to. I've found successful businesses are much better at broad guidance, but they've got an end state and they're adjusting and iterating through the process. They've got the framework and the processes in place to do that. And businesses that fail spend way too much time thinking about doing something and not enough time adjusting it after they've started.
Right. So rather than, you know, don't let perfect get in the way of progress. And then once you launch it, like you said, launch the boat, you need to have a process in place. And so ultimately, like, I kind of put that in the monitoring bucket. What are we monitoring? And like you said, how often are we adjusting? What would your advice be on that topic for businesses who are scaling to, whether it's 2 to 5 million, 5 to 10 million, 10 million to 20 or 30? You know, there's these definitive jumps in businesses where it's like, you know, you're a $1 million business owner, you just started your business, or you've been running your business for 5 or 10 years, you're doing $1 million, and then all of a sudden, you know, you start to catch fire, or you start to work some things out, and all of a sudden, your next thing, you're going into 5 million. But the processes have to change. Is there kind of some insight that you'd have on that based on the experiences you've had?
It is a huge issue in government contracting, because you have small business set aside. So there's an advantage to being small, and then they'll hit a big contract, and then suddenly they're no longer a small business and they compete on the larger side. And most of their energy is focused on the contract versus running the business. So you've got this disconnect of where you're spending your time and your mindshare. Some of it gets back to vision. So where do you envision the company being 5 years from now? And have you put the framework and the processes in place to do that? I'd rather see a business that has thought about, you know, 5 years from now, we're going to be X, you know, X size, and we'll need a C-suite of Y size, and I'm going to organize around that. Maybe not fill it. I'll fill it as we go forward, as opposed to, you know, I operate one way at $1 million. And then when I get to 5 millions, I'm going to completely rearrange the chairs on the deck. And when I get to 10 million, I'm going to do that. Having said that, I like the framework of structure, but I'm actually more interested in creating cross-functional teams to solve problems as you're going through it. So I like bringing people out of the formal structure for a variety of reasons to solve problems, and making that a routine way that you do business, which I think scales much better.
I would love for you to explain that, because it sounds somewhat obvious. Like, I love digging into those kinds of things, because that's where really the juice is for business operators or people who are trying to solve problems. But, you know, cross-functional teams, and some people don't have the resources necessarily to either bring people out of the organization. Like, if they're a mid-sized company, I've had that struggle in the past where it's like, you know, you don't have the resources, and like, how do you bring them out? But I'd be curious if you could just maybe talk a little bit about cross-functional teams from a perspective of solving, you know, problems that are happening in the organization.
When you're a startup, everything's cross-functional team, right? So, I mean, that's the way you're doing business, which is one of the cool things about being a startup. And then as you scale, suddenly you now have the line and block chart, and you've got responsibilities, and that's what I'm in charge of. And what I see a lot of is a particular line of business will work it, and then it comes up to the C-suite, and that becomes a cross-functional team, because we haven't made the effort at a lower level to establish. I think if you get into it routinely, if you use it routinely, and I'm talking not the C-suite, but the layers below that, and bringing those teams together, then it, you know, the first time you do it, everybody wants to be part of it because they think that's the hypos. But if you're doing it routinely, you're now seeing, as a CEO or leader, you're now getting to see talent two or three levels below you that on a normal business you wouldn't be able to do. Giving them the opportunity with a lead from one of your divisions to kind of shepherd it, it gives them authority. It ties them into kind of the larger objectives of the business, because you're establishing this cross-functional team to solve something that's important to you. And they're developing connections across the organization that typically wouldn't occur. And so the more you do that, the more resilient the organization becomes, the more communication channels are established, and you also get to see some talent. And what happens then is when you actually have a real crisis that you've got to do that, you've already built some of those, you know, muscle memory into the organization before you do it.
When you explain it like that, I mean, that's brilliant. And it sounds a lot like a version of a story that I heard regarding what was kind of done with the Iraq war and with JSOC and bringing everybody together. Is that kind of the basic fundamental drive of how you guys improve communication between all the different members that were involved from all the different countries and the different military streams?
Yeah, and it was out of necessity. I mean, there was really several phases to it. I mean, if you looked prior to 9/11, each one of the separate SOF units, we'll just call them tribes, each one of the tribes kind of operated on their own and then were brought together at the JSOC level for specific missions, and then everybody went back to doing what they were doing before that. The first phase of that was breaking that down, breaking the relationship down between the different tribes internal to SOF. And that took time, and it took a lot of energy and a lot of the things that we were talking about. General McChrystal drove that portion. And we were operating at a level that we had never operated before by 2004. And we were not winning, which means we were losing. We've never done it as good as we were doing it. We were working harder than we'd ever worked. We were hitting targets every single night. But to get out of that, we had to bring in other assets. And to your point, it was conventional forces, it was foreign forces, it was the NSA, CIA, all the technical capabilities. So you have now all these disparate groups. We didn't have the words back then, but now we would call it a catalytic community. And the stages of that were, you know, first establishing this knowledge network, which then evolved into an action network. And then ultimately, I would say, evolved into an impact network, which I've spending a lot of my time on right now, frankly, with Kurt on a different, in a different area. But that occurred over years. That was from really 2004 to probably 2010 during that time. And there was always an argument. I always wondered and had many discussions with General McChrystal, is there an organizational culminating point? Is there some point where you bring in so many people that the organization's no longer what the organization was? And I was wrong. He was able to continue to have that organization because of the very disciplined battle rhythm, because of the way that they communicated, because of the way we brought people in and sustain it for a long period of time.
Couple questions there. We're still on the very first piece where you said bigger than yourself. We haven't even... So thank you for, thanks a lot for your patience. I appreciate it, brother. You mentioned the word discipline, and then you also mentioned three things. I missed the first one. I apologize. There was action network, impact network. What was the first one?
A knowledge network or information network. Initially, you're building it and people will come because they are learning stuff that they didn't know before. Just because of the amount of operations that we were doing, what we were doing, how we were distributed, we were learning things about the terrorist network that nobody else knew. So people wanted to be part of that just to learn more. At some point, now you've developed enough of a relationship and enough level of trust that you can now coordinate actions within that. That's sequential. I mean, you have to have baseline level of trust and understanding so that actions can be coordinated, in some cases loosely coordinated, i.e. the agencies will go off and do other things, but largely based on the information that they're deriving from the network. And then finally, that you transition to the point that the network now impacts things outside of the network. It impacts policy decisions at the national level. It impacts the way other countries approach counterterrorism, the way they approach building their own SOF, the way technology companies build things that they hadn't built before. That's the kind of natural life cycle of it.
That's beautiful. Thank you for that.
And to be fair, we knew none of those words and we were just kind of doing it. And so a lot of the work is caught up with that. So I'm assigning words that we didn't know back then.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you guys were, I don't want to say shooting from the hip, but you were certainly practicing. I mean, it was a new field of battle. It was a new environment. And please correct me if anything I'm saying is wrong or misinterpreted. And it created a new way of thinking.
At that time, I was commanding the Ranger Regiment. So I had a third of my soldiers were deployed all the time, either in Iraq or Afghanistan, sometimes up to two thirds. And then the rest of them were back in the States, either recovering from deployment or getting ready to deploy. And we were in the middle of transforming the regiment because the way that we were organized, the way we had technology, was not conducive for the fight we were in. So we were doing a major reorganization or transformation of the regiment. At the same time, we're actively fighting in two countries out of, you know, 14, 15 different locations.
And how many thousands of people under your command, out of curiosity?
About 3,000 at that point.
That's in the Ranger Regiment?
Just in the regiment.
Wow. Discipline. You brought the word up, discipline. Since it came up, I'd love to, you know, dive deeper in terms of, I mean, I'm interested in exploring your concept of discipline, your philosophy on it, both from a micro standpoint, considering self, possibly, and how it leads out to, you know, the discipline at a macro level, whether you're a CEO of a company, you're a pastor of a church, you're a community leader, you have kids, you're obviously a successful father. I've heard that actually. So
not for my kids, probably, but.
So I'm just curious what your vision from kind of top to bottom is on discipline.
It's interesting because I've spent a lot of time thinking through this, because one of the things that we were transforming in the Ranger Regiment at the time I was talking about was I was trying to take, at that time, that organization was probably the most disciplined organization out there. The standards that we had, the way that we interacted, all that was very disciplined. I would argue, and did argue back then, that in some cases we weren't self-disciplined. So that's a different, but to get to a state of self-discipline, I think you've got to go through an environment of discipline. You've got to get the kind of fundamental skills and habits, because discipline ultimately is all about habits, to get to the point where you're doing the right thing when nobody's looking. One, you know what the right thing is, and two, you have the self-discipline to do it when nobody is there observing. In the military, that's what we do through the basic, you know, through the way we recruit and assess people. And clearly, when you get into special operations, there's a next level of that through this, you know, the assessment process that they go through, and then how you hold yourself to a standard every day as you're moving forward. In the Rangers, one of the things that binds this unique to the Ranger Regiment is the Ranger Creed. Every morning when you do physical training, every Ranger recites the Ranger Creed. And it's a long list of, you know, recognize a volunteer as Ranger, fully known the hazards of my chosen profession. And it goes on, there's six stanzas. Well, the first thing is you got to learn it, then you got to memorize it, then you repeat it every day, then you internalize it, and then you spend the rest of your life trying to live up to it. At its core, it's not a creed. It's actually a commitment to every other Ranger in the formation that you're going to hold yourself to those standards. And that, so it is a reinforcing function as you move forward. It's been tried in other places. It's okay, but it's not, I've never seen it as effective as it occurs there. Long answer, you got to have an environment of discipline. Whether that's at home, that you're building this environment of discipline that you're bringing your kids up in. Sports is a great outlet. Communities are great. So those boundaries that kind of define what right is, and then two is a force and function to kind of keep you on path to ultimately you achieve some level of self-discipline.
So as you were talking about that, I mean, I always am like, I have like two of an angel on one shoulder and a devil on the other shoulder. It always feels like, I'm curious if you would be interested in pitching and catching a bit on, you know, the question I wrote down here was, you know, what do we do today to impact kids for tomorrow? I had a guy on my podcast, actually an old business partner of mine who runs leadership camps for kids. And, you know, he was on the podcast and he had a pretty definitive thoughts about the need for awareness for parents to be involved, have more discipline, hold more structure for their kids. And I'm just curious, like, where you think that's going more with technology and what might happen. And then also what, you know, business owners or families can do in the current environment that they're living in?
It's a great question. I mean, because it's impacting on multiple levels. I mean, whether you're talking the workers in the office or at home, the hybrid mix of that all. I think it's one of the fundamental challenges that we're going to face as a society. I mean, there's a really interesting argument that when you combine AI and virtual reality or augmented reality, that the biggest threat is not the bombs going off generated by AI. The biggest threat is the dehumanization of the society over time, and that AI becomes, because we become human, we learn our habits through our interaction with our family, our friends, our community. If you're disconnected from your family, friends, community through an augmented reality headset and your AI buddy, that's the larger concern to me than the machines are going to take over the nuclear weapons. So how do you combat that? Well, I mean, one of the ways you combat that is there an AI co-pilot for parents to help navigate that process? Two is, you know, you've got to create the forcing functions that you can pulse the system. I'm not trying to divert it, but I have this philosophy that I use called the four C's, and every individual and organization kind of goes through the same process. You become competent, and as you become competent, you get confident, and at some level of confidence, you get complacent. And once you get complacent, you're headed for a catastrophe. And that occurs individually because we lack the self-discipline, or we lack, you know, the environment changes or whatever it is. It also occurs organizationally. So the art is, how do you pulse the system at the right time? How do you keep yourself and your organization in this band of confidence, but not allow it to get into complacency, or at a minimum, know when you're headed towards catastrophe? And, you know, so there's a variety of ways in organizations to do that. We have to do that individually. We do that individually through our network of friends, our mentors, our how we hold ourselves accountable, our community. I think as parents, we've got to work harder in this environment than we've ever had to work before to kind of maintain that and provide the framework, provide the environment of discipline for children, you know, as they move up. And frankly, society and community needs to step up as well. I mean, we need to continue to do things like the guy you had on the podcast is doing, that there are other outlets out there. Because sports was my outlet. It was one of my outlets. But that, you know, that's where you learned a lot of, you know, how to deal with others, discipline, structure. Well, the reality is there's just less opportunities for kids to play sports. I mean, it's really hard to become a high school athlete and with bigger schools and year round, where in my day, you know, pretty much everybody played every sport because that's what you did. You know, we've got to create those opportunities for them.
Yeah. And that's the risk. I think you were referring to Matt Shearer, who's from Under Armour, that podcast, because he was a professional lacrosse player. You're hitting on one of my biggest concerns. And, you know, I'm not a grandparent yet, but my kids are, you know, 19. My daughter's 19 and my son's 22. So there's an eventuality here probably that I'm going to be faced with that. And it's probably one of the things that as I look out 10, 20 years, I'm very concerned about it. I'm concerned about how we create these opportunities. Schools seem to have holding less accountability, less discipline for our kids, and just those communitas around us. It's just, I mean, everybody knew where I was, and yeah, I could get into some trouble, but there was an extent. And 50% of the trouble I did get in, my parents probably knew about it anyways, but let it slide. I mean, I was raised, my mom, she was pretty strict. This is concerning to me. Where do you feel it falls, you know, going forward, and what do we need to do about it?
I mean, I'm generally a glass is half full, so I'm an optimist. Maybe not as, you know, not as much as Kurt, who I just hang around him when I need a dose of optimism. But we used to have a mantra that the leadership skills that we learned are still required, but no longer sufficient, meaning, as the environments change, we still have to have the baseline leadership skills, but we have to we have to acquire new skills and a new way of operating in a new environment. And I would argue that families need to do that. They need to find new ways to operate in the environment in this where we're rapidly approaching with AI, machine learning. We haven't even talked quantum and augmented reality. But we also have to approach it differently from a community standpoint and then, you know, at some stage, a national standpoint. I believe that people will step up to do that. I'm trying to do it in my own little way with Kurt and Kieran on the information disorder crisis, because I think it's so fundamental to other stuff. We have to look at new ways to operate. AI is the worst it's ever going to be today. It will get better every single day. Learning how to operate in an environment and leveraging that technology, like we talked about before, using AI as a co-pilot to assist parents, educating their kids, teaching their kids, building community where we can bring kids together in ways that we haven't thought of before. Sports was the way that, you know, me and you grew up because it was an outlet. What are the other outlets that we can do? And there's examples of that. I mean, I was on the board of Team Red, White, and Blue, and it's replacing the old VFW as a veteran for foreign wars and American Legions, which were kind of where the old veterans used to get together around the bar and smoke cigarettes and drink beer. That's changed. Team Red, White, and Blue is about getting people together to do athletic events and putting them together with a network. So it creates a community of veterans, give them a new sense of purpose to do athletic events, and it's scaling at a grassroots level. I think reinforcing a lot of those kind of actions that are going on around us is important, amplifying those and getting our kids involved.
You talked about what you're doing with Kurt and Kieran. You want to jump into that? You want to share what you guys are doing in there? Or?
We're still at the relatively early days of it, but our thesis is the information disorder crisis was defined by Aspen a couple of years ago, and it's really about you can't trust the veracity of what's on the internet. You don't know if it's an individual or a bot. The eyeball kind of advertising that generates this angst across the internet and in television and all that is changing the way that we interact with each other.
Are you saying all those hot girls that reach out to me on social media aren't real?
It could be. I don't know.
They're not. Trust me, I already know.
It's a wicked problem because there's so many different aspects to it. There's regulatory stuff. There's technology stuff. There's social media stuff. There's, you know, AI stuff. There's just the way the civil discourse of the society, all of those things are around this problem. And our goal is to create a catalytic community around solving it, much in the way we just talked about that we did at JSOC. Can we build a network of individuals and then create, kind of go through the process of going from an information or knowledge network to where we're generating action to ultimately having an impact outside of the network to the rest of it? And there's a lot of activities that are going on, but there's none of them are really, at least so far, we haven't seen a lot of them that are linked together. To get back to the original thing, it's something that I think is important. I've got kind of a sense of purpose around that. I know that you can build catalytic communities and solve really hard problems. And, you know, I've got the time and resources to kind of do that. And I get to work with Kurt and Kieran. So,
yeah, well, those are two really smart guys. And I love what you're doing there. And I'm going to see those guys in Morocco in May, first week of May. So I'm sure we'll be talking quite a bit about it. I'm looking forward to catching up with them on that. You know, everything that you're talking about here is going to require some type of process or event to get people to gather together in a bigger way to solve a bigger problem. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see if there's any opportunities to get involved with you guys and maybe support it or help it out or whatever. But holy smokes, Craig, we're so far off the...
I'll go down whatever path you want to go down.
This is awesome. I mean, this is great. This is a, you know, great conversation. I appreciate your insights. It's so fantastic. You know, if I even take us back to the very beginning, we talked about the you know, the bigger than yourselves, which is how we got down this track. And, but you really talked about the other second thing that you talked about was, you know, being able to do the job two levels down and one level up, which I thought is really, you know, really interesting because, you know, just from a corporate level, I think sometimes that gets lost. I think that that whole concept, and I'd love to kind of hear what you have to say about that, especially in organizations that are, they're scaling. It seems like nowadays, when I talk to friends of mine who own businesses, we see it in our businesses. Resources are stretched. People are, they're really kind of stretched out and they're doing everything they can. And there's this sometimes a miss, I think, in training level up and then, and also the level down piece too, which I think is really interesting. And I'd love to get your perspective on it and how you guys did it either in the military or how you carried it forward in organizations and how you led that.
Like I said, the military was pretty regimented in how they approached it. So at every, you went through formalized training at the basic course. 3 years later, you went through another institutional training at the career course is what they call it. So as a captain, so you go from kind of organizationally, you'll go from running, being in charge of 40 people to being in charge of 150 people to being in charge of 750 to 800 people to being in charge of 3,000 people to ultimately for the guys at division level of 15,000. So there is a series of courses, institutional courses that do that. That's one aspect. The other aspect is there is this self-learning side to it and they resource pretty well as you go through. And then you get experiences as you're going through. The size of the organization, there's a change point, kind of the, I didn't know it back then, but kind of the rule of 150 applies when you're looking at those organizations. And then finally, I think just as important is your network, your peer network and your mentors as you go through it. So again, it's a great way to learn leadership. It's been done really well. I mean, they've done some tweaks to it, but it's still the largely the same. You know, 40 years later. In business, you can't do it the same way, but there's things that you can do in business that give you the same effect. Like I said, one of them is cross-functional team and being able to use cross-functional teams because you're exposing people to things that they haven't seen before. I think as importantly, what we talked about earlier is the way you, the forums that you have and the way those forums actually operate. So if as in organizations that I ran, two levels down were attending at least one of the forums that I was in and were getting context probably weekly. And then the focus. So if I think in our organization, I believe the center of gravity was actually, and this is a government contracting business, but the center of gravity was program managers and capture managers. So program managers, because they ran the contracts and we're interfacing with the customers at the tactical level, if you will. Capture managers, because in the business development side of government contracting, they were the ones that actually were the sales force, if you will. Our structure was designed to enable them. So when I talk to the C-suite, it's like, you are here to enable program managers and capture managers. Our forums should be designed to give them the information that they need to be successful to execute the objectives that we've laid out for them. Our metrics should be designed to track their progress against that. So you create that by the focus on it. Separate but related. I believe it's important for, in the military, it was important for leaders to share hardship and share risk on a variety of levels. So even as a general officer, I would go out onto objectives and spend time with soldiers, not because I was any value added to them. You know, my days of kicking in doors and clearing rooms were long, long gone at that point. But it was important that they saw that I was willing to share risk with them and that I actually was out there, you know, with my sleeves rolled up in the dirt with on a variety of levels. And it was important for me because I could cut through a lot of this stuff to understand what was going on at the ground. I think the same thing applies in business. I think CEOs have to pick and choose, but they ought to regularly pick something to run with that gets down into the tactics. And largely on the, you know, the day-to-day basis, they're operating, most of their energy is an up and out at that level, but there's great value in picking things that you want to drill down in with a cross-functional team, either because it's something that you're looking at for the future or it's something that could potentially become a crisis. I think it keeps you in the game. It keeps you kind of knowledgeable about what's going on at that level. And frankly, you learn a lot as you go through it too. So it keeps you current at that level. You know, you're not sharing risk, but you're sharing hardship. And there's nothing that builds a team like a little shared hardship. So I think picking and choosing opportunities to do that's very important.
And attaching some cadence to that, I think too, eh? Like, I love the phrase share hardship and share risk. That is not something you typically would hear in business, but certainly I surmise you might hear in the military, but it's really, you know, bang on and couldn't be missed by a CEO, right? They're focused on the bigger picture stuff and getting down into it. I have a friend that was on the podcast, Mark Bradley, and he spends 100 days with customers and 100 days with his staff. And he schedules those out almost a year in advance. And he's extremely disciplined with his calendar, but he makes sure that he is, you know, and that would be a good example of sharing hardship and sharing risk and really reiterating this point so that the listeners are chiming into it, because I think it's a critical point that you're making. Do you mind if we circle back a little bit to forums, and maybe if you could give some context to forums and because I think you had mentioned inside of forums that you would have one level down from you, I believe you said, would be involved in the forum. What would a forum look like? What would that look like in the military? Maybe what would it look like in your business career?
As you remember, we had a variety of forums that we used in the military. I'll just focus on the business since that's probably more applicable than most people, but we had a pretty disciplined, I tended to do my forums on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. And Monday was like the kind of classic business update. This is every week, so classic business update, operations kind of meeting. Wednesday was a deep dive, so I blocked time on Wednesday to deep dive whatever. If, let's say, we were looking to expand the business in a different country, then a cross-functional team would be put together, come in, kind of give the assessment on what we'd call the intelligence preparation of the battlefield or IPB, and then courses of action to implement that. So that rotated. It was either for the growth of the business or something that I was focused on that I thought, you know, could potentially turn into a crisis that you're trying to get ahead of, but it was a standard block. And then Friday was really a growth meeting. So it was business development and sales. So those were the weekly meetings. And we had a once a month business update, and that all fed into the quarterly update, which fed into the kind of semi-annual strategy briefing. So all those layered in as we went forward. And then they were pretty large forums, and I frankly got some pushback on, you know, you're taking us away from, you know, our work and we could be doing this or that or whatever. My response was, look, I'm taking 4 hours a week. So at a maximum, I'm taking 10% of your time if you're working a 40-hour week. And of course, nobody was working a 40-hour week. And secondly, if we're running those forums correctly, this is not a meeting where you're providing me information to make a decision. It's a forum where we are giving the information to the right people to make the right decisions at their level. Done correctly, you gain tremendous amounts of time through that. You cut down on all these multiple subset meetings and emails and requests and information papers and all that kind of stuff, because you just get to it in the forum and move on. But it has to be, you know, very disciplined, have an agenda and people talk, but it's typically not the C-suite that are talking, it's somebody below their level, depending on what we were talking about.
So typically you would not be the one that's speaking. are you checkboxing all the information that's being delivered, or are you just trusting that person providing it is going to be spot on?
I wouldn't check before the meetings occur, because we're going to talk about it in the meeting. I always view my role in that is to provide context and intent. If it got to me for a decision, it was a hard problem, because I expected easy problems to be solved long before they got to me. And somebody was just reporting out that they had solved X, Y, or Z problem. We were moving on. And we could run a separate decision brief for a hard problem in, you know, in the Wednesday slot or something like that. But information is like oxygen. And you almost have to think of it like CPR. If you're not pumping, doing CPR constantly in your organization, the organization's going to start dying. And so my view is, that's the reason I use forums versus meetings, because it's just from a mindset standpoint. Those are about getting information out. Let me expand on it, because it might help. I'm going to use military. In every military organization, there's six channels of communication that flow all the time. There's the chain of command. That's the, you know, the officers, the commanders. There's the non-commissioned officer chain. That's the sergeants major and, you know, the senior non-commissioned officers. There's the staff. That's like your intel officer, your operations officer. That's the special staff, like your surgeon, you know, your psychologist, chaplain, all those guys. There's rumor control, and there's the fastest channel out of all of them. That's the spouses chain. So those six channels run all the time. Now, as a leader, you can train those channels to communicate or not. They're going to run regardless. So you can enable them. You can link them together to get efficiencies out of them. You can use those channels to inform your decisions and to communicate your decisions or not. And so you've got to have a holistic kind of communication strategy that affects all those channels of communication. A lot of organizations just rely on the top two. They're not linking those others in. And there are some decisions that don't require all the channels. I mean, they're pretty basic decisions to move on. But if you're making a cultural decision, if you're changing culture, if you're making a big shift in strategy, it requires both being informed by all those channels and informing all those channels. And oh, by the way, it's not just your organization, it's the organization above you and below you, because they've all got channels too. Businesses are the same way. So CEOs ought to know what channels of communication are flowing in their organization and ought to have a plan to bring those channels together, train them how to talk, enable them, use them to inform their decisions, use them to communicate their decisions. So when I think of forums, when I say forums, I'm talking about ways that I'm bringing the right people together at the right frequency to make the right decisions. That's kind of in a nutshell.
And so these forums, would they be virtual?
Well, I mean, there's a combination of people that are there, but we were, when I left Constellis, we were in 30 countries. So everything we do has got to be virtual now to some degree.
And if you have an organization, I'd say most of the organizations that listen to this podcast would be 5 to 20 million in revenue, maybe 30 million. Would you apply the same kind of cadence and the same kind of forum process? Which ones of these would be like all channels of communication, everybody's tuned in to listen to it?
Of course, we did all hands. And my rhythm was every 3 months I was doing the loop, traveling to hit all the sites. I mean, I had an engagement strategy of surrogates that were doing the same thing, reinforcing the same message to get face to face. So that, but I never got everybody together. A smaller company, yes, you can bring everybody together for an all hands meeting. I just never had the opportunity. I mean, it was too big of an organization to do that. I think you learn a lot of bad habits, because if you bring everybody together and you say it one time and you think they all heard it, you're wrong. I have a rule of five. If I'm not willing to say it five times, I shouldn't be angry when somebody doesn't get it. So you've got to be repetitive and on message and continue to communicate it. Because in most organizations, everybody's not going to be there. Even if it's a small organization, somebody's going to be out, somebody's going to be having a bad day. So you've got to be repetitive as you go forward. The other thing is, it gets back to what we talked about earlier. If your vision is to be a big company, then build processes that will scale. Build the virtual aspect in early. It doesn't cost you any extra money. And that's scalable. If it's bringing everybody together every month, well, that's not scalable. I mean, it's nice, but it's not scalable. And I'm not arguing that you shouldn't bring people together frequently, because I think most creativity is done in person, not virtually, but it's some combination of that.
I mean, as you're talking about this whole, your form process, I mean, I can see gaps in our own organizations where we could take advantage of this type of, you know, methodology and process that would, you know, improve up and down communication. Hey, everyone. Thanks so much for listening to this conversation and the time we spent with Brigadier General Craig Nixon, and just learning some of the tools and the tricks and how he fostered his leadership over time, not only in the military, but onwards to grow, you know, a company to $1 billion in revenue is an unbelievable accomplishment. Please tune in next week on Wednesday. We'll release the second part of this conversation as he even goes deeper into some of these tools and the psychology and the strategies that he used. Again, I'm super grateful for the time you spent with us, General Nixon, and listeners, please, next week, you can't miss it. It's really unbelievable. So thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week. Appreciate you. Thanks for listening. I appreciate you being with us. If you found value in the show and know a friend or a coworker who could benefit from the conversation, please share the link via text or on social media. Remember, each share creates a ripple effect of knowledge and inspiration. We'll see you next week.
The views, information, or opinions expressed by guests during the Business of Doing Business podcast are solely those of the individuals involved and do not necessarily represent those of Duane Kerrigan and his affiliates. Duane Kerrigan, or the Business of Doing Business podcast, is not responsible for and does not verify the accuracy of any of the information contained in the podcast series. The primary purpose of this podcast is to educate and inform. Listeners are advised to consult with a qualified professional or specialist before making any decisions based on the content of this podcast.